Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. I am thrilled to have with us a friend and colleague of many years. His name is Todd Bensman. He is one of our country's preeminent authorities on, well, the invasion that is taking place in the southern border of the United States and has now been for the duration of this presidency. It is reaching epic proportions, and we're going to talk with Todd about why that is and what its implications will be for all of us, not just in the so-called border states, but every state in the union, because we're all border states now. Todd Bensman is the National Security Fellow of an indispensable organization, the Center for Immigration Studies. He is also the author of a superb book, America's Secret Border War. He writes prolifically and contributes mightily to this public policy debate about one of the most important national security and homeland security issues we face. Todd Bensman, it's great to have you back at Securing America. Thank you for taking the time, sir.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, give us a little bit of level setting on what the border looks like at the moment, Todd. The magnitude of this invasion, just maybe a snapshot from last month's statistics.
Well, again, we're in the ionosphere on apprehension numbers, 158,000 apprehensions at the southern border in the month of February. That's a little bit higher than what we had in January, but it's all in the ionosphere, places that we have never been in United States history. Altogether, we're looking at about 2.4 million in the last 12-month period. This is not including gotaways, which is probably another 400,000 or 500,000. So the numbers are just like we've never been here before, and that continues.
400,000 to 500,000 number is obviously a ballpark on those who have managed to elude the border patrol and are, heavens knows, here for what purpose. But the sheer volume of this, some 3 million people, I guess, in the past year, would be truly on the scale of an invasion. Our friend Steve Bannon likes to talk about D-Day involving something on the order of 150,000 troops. For heaven's sakes, I mean, this is staggering in terms of the numbers. And I'm always minded to ask, of that number, Todd, how many would you expect are military-age men, for want of a better term, and unaccompanied at that?
Well, again, that's really a tough one to talk about because of the gotaway numbers. The Title 42 pandemic pushback rule from the Trump era targets mostly adult males, so we do have a good sense that very significant numbers in the probably a good half a million, million point three or four were going to be men or singles. You could say they were singles. I don't actually know how many were men versus women, but a lot of those get away because we ended deportation in the interior. So the whole goal for those people to not get pushed back into Mexico is to get past the 100-mile mark at the border. Beyond that, Border Patrol feels like it has no jurisdiction, and then it becomes a matter of ICE and ICE is stood down right now. There is no interior deportation. So those military aged men and women or whatever are, you know, getting away into the interior. Yeah. We don't know.
I want to drill down a couple of different things that you talked about there, Todd. Title 42 may not be a term that everybody's familiar with. And more to the point, it seems to be going away. What is it and why does that matter in terms of what we're experiencing here?
So for those who follow the border emergency or crisis or invasion, Title 42 is very important. It's very significant. It's going to matter for the next phase of this emergency. Title 42 is an authority that's not granted by the Immigration and Naturalization Act. It's granted by regular U.S. code for presidents who are trying to control a pandemic, which Donald Trump invoked in March of 2020. This required that Border Patrol pushes back 100% of everybody that they catch crossing into the border with no opportunity for an asylum claim. So Biden came in and he kept that, except he caused the border crisis primarily by exempting wide swaths of wide categories of migrants, unaccompanied minors and family units were allowed to be exempted from that. And those are the ones that are making up the vast mass migration crisis. But the majority of people coming across the border were in totality were being pushed back under Title 42, probably two-thirds. Just one-third is the one that made up the crisis that we're seeing. As early as April 1, coming right up, the Biden administration can suspend Title 42 for all the rest. That is the thing to watch for next. I say when, not if, because Title 42 was never intended to be permanent, even by Trump. This thing had to go away at some point. But the Biden administration has been clinging to this, really secretly pleased that they at least have that, because they were able to push back so many. But when that goes away as early as April 1, then we are going to see something of a magnitude that you have not seen before in this country. Even the administration is predicting 170,000 more in the initial wave. And they're preparing right now. They're bringing in planes, jets, buses. They're putting volunteer lists for calling for federal workers from all over the country to be prepared to come down to deal with what's going to happen when they do away with Title 42.
And that brings me to the next point, Todd. What are those planes and trains and automobiles or buses for? Is it to take those people and send them home?
Well, right. Well, I don't think that it's to send people home. I think that those are going to be to manage for example, Texas will be overwhelmed completely. All the detention facilities, whatever we've got in place here, will be immediately overwhelmed. So the jets are going to be taking migrants to other, like California and Arizona, and maybe in the interior facilities that are empty, so that they have a place to put them for a while. But I believe that probably all of them are going to claim asylum, for which all of them are ineligible, most likely. It's just it's a scheme to get into the country, as you know. And so I think that we are probably going to be so swamped. I hope I'm wrong, but I've been down there too much to know better. But I think that all of our facilities and everything that we've got in place is going to be so swamped that they're probably just going to have to just wholesale let people, just let them go, wave them
but
through.
But then it's not just a question of letting them go in, say, Texas. It's a question of then using these various means of transportation to move them all over the United States, no?
Well, that's true. You know, we saw that in the beginning. They were just being, you know, put on buses to all four corners. They still are. That's happening even now.
Hold the thought, Todd, because we're going to come back with more on what that means for the communities impacted, of course, and what it means for the homeland security of the United States, something that I think is clearly great peril for all of us. We're going to hear more about it right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Amidst Russia's wholesale destruction of Ukraine, growing trouble much closer to home is getting scant attention. We're about to lose what's left of free Latin America to our indigenous and foreign enemies there, with calamitous economic, demographic, and national security consequences here. Straws in the wind include Chile's new Marxist government's installation of the granddaughter of former communist president Salvador Allende as its defense minister. Cartels engorged on the money they've made smuggling across our southern border since Joe Biden opened it are waging all-out war against the Mexican military. And impending elections may well result in anti-American leftists running the table in their last two holdouts, Colombia and Brazil. We must secure our southern border, oppose Chinese and Russian support for their regional communist international, the Forum of Sao Paulo, and stand with those in Latin America who love freedom. This is Frank Gaffney.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're talking with Todd Bensman about the crisis at our border, and that term is used often, and it sounds hyperbolic, but if you thought it was bad before, what Todd is now forecasting in terms of what happens once this so-called Title 42 provision is waived, essentially for everybody trying to get into this country, we're going to see an epic invasion on a scale unprecedented in our history. Todd, talk a little bit about, based on your experience, not just at the Center for Immigration Studies, but also your previous lives as a world-class investigative reporter and as a national security intelligence analyst for the Department of Public Safety in Texas. What does this actually mean in terms of people who are coming here to do us harm? Not the economic migrants, but people who are coming from places that are hostile to our country and who have an agenda that may be to further that hostility at the expense of Americans, perhaps mortally harming them. And through what kinds of techniques is that being done?
Well, of course, we have migrants in this particular emergency or invasion. We have migrants coming from all over the Middle East, South Asia. Afghanis or Afghan immigrants are crossing all the time now. We have people coming from Somalia and Mauritania and all of those countries of terrorism concern. And when you have a border breakdown like this, where all systems are collapsed, those people are coming through as well. And we're unable to screen them as well and know who they are as well and be able to deport them. I want to give you just one demonstrative example that happened in December where a Venezuelan, lots of Venezuelans crossing right now, Lebanese-born Venezuela cross, swam the Rio Grande in Brownsville. And he flagged on the FBI's terrorism watch list. Now, typically when that happens, the FBI goes down there. I write in America's Covert Border War, and we interrogate and do, try to collect intelligence. And they did that with this. And they declared that he was a high risk with substantial derogatory intelligence as a Category 5 group member, probably Hezbollah, but it didn't say that. And a flight risk. And ICE headquarters intervened and ordered him released because he was overweight and they needed to clear the detention centers for COVID. That guy is running around in the Detroit area pursuing asylum, of all things. So that's the kind of thing that happens when you have a border crisis. You have just, and nobody noticed it. Nobody knew. Somebody got so mad in the federal government that they leaked the documents, which I have. So that's how we even know about that case. But I suspect that there are a lot more like that. We've had Saudis cross who are on the FBI terror watch list. We have Yemenis who crossed in California. The Mexicans caught a Yemeni on the FBI terror watch list and let him go because they're overwhelmed too and they needed detention space. So he's running around. We don't know where he is. And that's not even talking about MS-13 gang members and cartel people and all the rest.
So these are people who are not just involved in human smuggling or drug smuggling. They could be involved in smuggling weapons and perhaps even weapons of mass destruction in furtherance of their harmful agenda, whether it's jihadism or whether it's motivated by some other animus towards this country. And Todd Benzman, in the course of your career, you've seen the toll taken by these folks, whether it's fentanyl, perhaps, whether it's the petty criminal activity or the possibility of mass destruction as well. This administration seems indifferent to this problem. Is that overstating it, or am I missing something?
I think that the Biden administration is privately very concerned about this because of the midterm elections. They are polling as badly as anybody can poll on an issue. This is their worst issue. It's going to drag everything down. The mainline Democratic Party leadership is worried about this. But publicly, they won't say much about it because they don't want to draw attention to it. They much prefer to be talking about Ukraine and the Russia conflict. Honestly, I think that's a tail wagging the dog kind of a scenario there. I really believe that. But this is something that they recognize. I believe they recognize as a threat in 2022 and especially in 2024 if they can't get a handle on it. And they are doing some things, Frank. They are doing some things that have so angered their progressive left wing that they've had a walkout of three or four key progressive liberal immigration advisors, which I find hopeful.
Yeah, I hope they'll all go. But the question, I guess, Todd, that answer prompts is they're concerned, all right, but they're not necessarily concerned about the national security or homeland security of the country. They're concerned about their political repercussions, down ballot, among others. So, Todd, among the things that is happening as a result of all of this, the immense boosting of criminal activity, particularly among the cartels on the other side of the border, and increasingly, I think there's evidence, as you know better than anybody, of it happening on our side of the border as well, is the upgunning, if you will, of these cartels to the point where they're now taking on the military of Mexico directly in huge firefights. I think Nuevo Laredo was a spectacular one just last week or so. Talk a little bit about that and what are we going to have to do lest that spill over in a very, very dangerous way on top of the problem we've just been talking about?
Well, the Mexican cartels, as we know, your viewers should know, control the border. They control what gets in, vast, long swaths of that border. Nobody crosses in without their permission and say so, and you got to pay them in huge swaths of the border. And they're very powerful, and they've gotten incredibly rich off of this, millions of migrants coming through, incredibly wealthy and powerful. And that goes in line with the Obrador administration's stance toward the cartels, which is hands off from the very beginning of the Obrador. Yeah. Right. Obrador has been like, let them operate. We're not in a war with them. And I think that that is not doing us any good. There was an operation last week where it was an FBI-led operation with the Mexican military and intelligence services that actually apprehended the CDN cartel's leader and got him back over the border to our side, which is the first time I've seen anything like this in all the years of Obrador. That just doesn't happen. I'm not sure why that happened. The gun battles that we saw in Nuevo Laredo were an attempt by his followers to slow down his, they knew he had been captured, to slow down his extradition. But the point is that that is a rare operation. We need to see a lot more of that type of operation. I don't know why they did it then, but it probably had something to do with, yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's a hopeful sign, and it is in contrast with another operation, and we don't have time to talk about it today, but I hope we'll catch you back on soon to discuss the ant operation that the Mexican government is running that apparently is actually helping get people into this country rather than defend that border. Todd Benzman, your work is indispensable. I commend you for America's Covert Border War. I think I misspoke earlier. It's America's Covert Border War. Terrific book. I hope people will check it out, as well as your cumulative work at the Center for Immigration Studies. That's CIS.org. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us soon if you would. Next up, we're going to speak with one of our country's preeminent experts on Iran about another blight on our national security that the administration is perpetrating, a new deal with the mullahs. That and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and it's a special pleasure to be able to say we are joined by one of the world's preeminent experts on the Iranian regime that has been an affliction to its own people and a threat to the rest of us, increasingly so, for decades now. His name is Dr. Harold Rode. He is one of the longtime duty experts on both Iran and the Middle East more generally for the United States Department of Defense, now retired after decades of distinguished service there, and is a distinguished senior fellow these days at the Gatestone Institute. He is a valued contributor to our work and has been for many years. And I'm very pleased to have him here to talk about, well, the subject of one of his most important books, I believe, The History of Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On, as practiced by the mullahs of Iran. Harold Rode, welcome to Securing America. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Wonderful being with you, Frank, and thanks for all these nice compliments. I hope I live up to
what you said. They're heartfelt and they're deserved, as in this case. Let me ask you first, Harold, to set the scene for us. We're going to talk in length about what has been going on in successive efforts to dissuade the mullahs, the ayatollahs, of their nuclear ambitions. But I want to start with you by talking about how long have they had those ambitions? How far back does this go in the so-called Islamic Republic of Iran's, you know, agenda?
I would say it goes way back to the beginning of Islam. You use any Islam, any weapon you have to advance Islam. Now, I would say for the mullahs, it's very simple. What do they see? They learn, they think about what goes on in the world. Unlike us, what we have this phrase in English, oh, that's history, something that happened 3 hours ago. But for them, they look for what it's all about. And they have seen that every nation that develops nuclear weapons is untouchable. And it can get away with murder, and in many instances it does. Look what Russia is doing. Look what China has been doing. The only one that hasn't is the United States of America. The others haven't used it. And so that's what they want. They think this will give them, this will insulate them, it will inoculate them.
So this has been clearly an object of their ambitions going back, I guess, to Ayatollah Khomeini. We've now got the Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. And we have insisted for years that he can be dissuaded from pursuing this objective. It doesn't make any sense, Harold, based on what you've said about the historic attachments to this ambition. But has there been anything that has been done to this point that has actually measurably prevented them from pursuing it, would you say?
Oh, the only thing that will is to instill in them the fear of God or the fear of the President of the United States. Since I retired, which is 2010, I think, January, whatever, all I can tell you is there's only been 4 years when they were petrified. They tried a little things here and there. They tried to get away. They're always testing us. But by and large, they were afraid of President Trump. This guy, if you read the Iranian press and you read how they talk among themselves, it's very clear this guy is at our beck and call. And frankly, the way they do it, I don't know how I'm going to say this in polite language. What matters in Iran is who's on top. It doesn't matter who's on top, rather on bottom. Who's on top is the one who's powerful. He controls the game. Anybody else, male, female, or whatever, they're the losers. And the United States is now showing that it is on the bottom. That's not good.
Harold, this is true. I think it's fair to say, based on all I've learned from you over the years, not just in Iran, but this is the general culture of the Middle East, is it not? And it seems that there's a special contempt felt by people who live in this, well, dog-eat-dog world, I guess you might call it, for those who actually have power and as a result should be on top, but deliberately choose not to be. Am I right about that, that there's a sort of special contempt for such people?
That's how they understood Obama and Secretary of State Kerry at the time. And that's how, in spades, they understand Biden and the people negotiating now. It's not negotiation. It's submitting. That's it.
Submission. Yeah. Harold, before we get to the present moment, because I'm going to come to it, but I want to start, though, with that particular dangerous period when, as you say, they had contempt for President Barack Obama and his then Vice President, Joe Biden, and the team of people who they assigned to negotiate with the Iranians, notably, but not exclusively, the then Secretary of State, John Kerry. The object of that time was to get something that came to be called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Remind us, what was the upshot of those efforts and the lengths that Kerry and company went to get that particular deal, which President Trump, as you pointed out, considered to be the worst in history?
Well, the Iranians know how to best people, as I used in the previous example. And what happened under John Kerry and President Obama? Let's just look at Iranian cartoons in the newspapers. The more that we gave in to them, we began to see cartoons in Iranian newspapers depicting President Obama. It emphasized, let us say, his Afro-American features. Now, why is that important? Because the subtle message in Iranian culture is that black-skinned people are inferior. And the more we gave in, the more the images became, let's say, darker in the newspapers. This is crazy. Now, what about John Kerry? John Kerry, at one point, was on crutches. Now, anybody who has a defect like that, for whatever reason, in this case, I understand that Kerry broke his leg or something, then all the cartoons had him on crutches. And that is, he, you know, we're on top, they're on the bottom. The more we gave in, that's what happened. And it got worse.
To some extent, Harold, is this not really just a manifestation of sort of the culture of the bazaar, that you go into to buy a rug in the bazaar and you're prepared to pay any price the merchant might charge? That price just grows and grows and grows. And that certainly seemed to be the case in this instance. In this, the European allies, as I recall, Harold, actually derided John Kerry as well, saying he was behaving like he was the Iranians' lawyer in these negotiations. So what came of all of that, Harold?
What came of all of that is we signed an agreement. And again, the chief Iranian negotiator, the Iranian foreign minister at the time, Zarif, wrote a book in which he explained how it all worked and how he basically got Kerry to agree on all sorts of things. And the way he did it, he basically said is, they became very close personal friends. And at one point he writes, Kerry was talking about some problem and even crying. Anybody who cries is weak. And it's like, and what Zarif's point was, I got him where I wanted him. And we became, we went to each other's weddings, all sorts of stuff like that. I don't remember the details. It really doesn't matter. It's they were the ones who dictated to us, and our response was to say, yes, sir. And we did, there were all sorts of side agreements, and I don't know what they were, but if there are side agreements, it means they're afraid to have them come out in public. We must be really, really embarrassed, or they must have been very, that is, our people, the Americans must have been very embarrassed, but God forbid it should get out in public.
Right. At the end of the day, as I recall, Harold, this thing was such a dog's breakfast, as they say, that the administration declined to even bring it forward for Congress's consideration, the Senate's advice and consent, as one would a proper treaty. In the end, they kind of blew it through the Congress on majority votes, but with an awful lot of people, including prominent Democrats, sharply critical of it, and I guess basically holding their nose. Harold, we're going to pause for just a second for a moment to come back to this topic of the legacy of that negotiation, the product of the deal that, as I say, Donald Trump reviled and actually repudiated when he became president of the United States, and the extent to which the same people who brought us that terrible deal, manifestly defective, manifestly unavailing in terms of actually restricting, let alone preventing the Iranians from getting a bomb, have been put back in charge and are now negotiating this nuclear deal 2.0 with the Iranians and are apparently imminently going to unveil it in all of its odious character. We're going to talk with Harold Rode about what this new deal looks like and what it will mean, not just for the Iranian people or even for the region, but for us as well. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined once again, I'm pleased to say, by Dr. Harold Rode, an eminent expert on Iran and the culture of the mullahs who govern there by brutal force, and who seek through jihad to spread their domination elsewhere around the world, not just the Muslim world, by the way, but throughout other parts of it, including through death and destruction against Israel and us here in the United States as well. Harold, I did want to just come back as we set the stage for this conversation about what has been happening on Joe Biden's watch, with the recollection that going back literally to the founding of the Islamic Republic in Iran, when Jimmy Carter made the terrible strategic error of having the Grand Ayatollah Khomeini come back to Iran and ultimately take over in a civil war, I guess you'd call it, or action against the then Shah of Iran, ever since that time, it has been an endless incantation of this regime, death to Israel and death to America, the little Satan and the great Satan. How has that informed what these negotiations have been producing under Joe Biden and this warmed over negotiating team of his dating back to the Obama years?
I want to add one other thing besides death to America and death to Israel. When Khamenei or any other senior Iranian gives speeches, there's invariably a sign in Persian above his head in the back. And it says, America can't do a damn thing. And that's who we are. And I want to go back, if you don't mind, you mentioned Jimmy Carter. What happened was, all of a sudden, we allow this guy, we basically help him go back to Iran, and he does exactly, Frank, what you said. And they take over the American embassy, which they thought they were going to have for a few days or something. Something awful would happen, and they'd have to leave. Well, it didn't happen that way. They held our diplomats hostage for 444 days. When and why did they release them? Because we can learn so much from that. They literally, 45 minutes before Ronald Reagan took the oath of office, raised his hand, they put all of our diplomats on an airplane. And at the moment that it crossed out of Iranian airspace was the moment that Ronald Reagan raised his hand to take the oath of office. They were afraid that this cowboy was going to do God knows what. And what is the proof that they react only to strength? Is that they also threatened at the time, after they took over the American embassy, to take over the Soviet embassy. There was a Soviet Union way back when. And the Soviets told them very simply, you know, we understand you've done this. Now you have 4 hours to give it up. If you don't, there won't be a Tehran anymore because we will obliterate it. And you know exactly what happened, Frank. The Iranians got out of the Soviet embassy as quickly as possible. Come, let us reason together doesn't work.
Yeah. Harold, so that, yeah, that brings us to this particular exercise that the Biden team has been going through. Again, and some of the names of these characters are very familiar to those of us who've been following their antics over the years. Robert Malley being the chief of this project and having a terrible record in the past. People like Wendy Sherman, now the Deputy Secretary of State.
A former social worker. That's what her qualifications are.
Right. Well, here's the thing. They've all been diplomats now for some time, so those are their qualifications. But they behave like, I don't know, people who are completely clueless about the nature of the dynamics they're involved in. And Harold, just speak to this question, because it seems to me so important. It goes back to something you touched on earlier, but it can't be emphasized enough. The Iranians have been humiliating these guys at every turn, have they not? And doesn't that tell you really what you need to know about not only how far they've lurched from peace through strength, but how completely counterproductive all of this is going to be in terms of a good outcome for the United States of America?
Look, in the Middle East in general, and specifically in this case in Iran, you only negotiate after you win, after you're the victor. And then you sit down and you basically dictate the terms that the loser is going to, the framework in which he is to function. If you want to negotiate before you have won, you are signaling to the other side in the Middle East that you either don't have the ability or the will to stand up. And in the Middle East, that once they see weakness, there's no such thing as confidence building measures and all this other sweet stuff that we've invented here in the West. Their response is they pounce, they jump, and they get you. And that's
so
what they're doing.
Just as an example of this, Harold, you've had the Iranians refusing actually to meet with the Americans throughout these negotiations under Biden. You've had them insisting on terms that are clearly, designed to demonstrate our weakness and fecklessness. And most recently, we've actually entrusted the role of intermediary, not just to the Europeans who were at least nominally on our side, but to the Russians at the very moment that we are, trying desperately to tremendously penalize them. It's hard to imagine a more incoherent policy approach or one more designed to fail dismally, except in the sense that it produces some sort of document, some sort of understanding, shall we say, like the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that won't produce the desired results. Harold, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more. And I want to talk on the other side with you about how, at the end of the day, we're going to have the bomb in Iran's hands, and it may be very quickly, and what the implications are of that, again, not just for the people of Iran or for the people of the Middle East, notably in Israel, but for the people of the United States of America as well. Terrible betrayal, among other things. We'll get into that with Harold Roden right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome once again. We are visiting with Dr. Harold Rode, one of the most thoughtful analysts and most informed experts about the minds of the Iranian mullahs and their subordinates, something that unfortunately is in very short supply at this moment in the Biden administration. And you can see the results of that shortcoming in terms of the deal that is now dribbling out in its details. Harold, talk a little bit about what we know, these guys, Bob Malley and Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and the rest have so far apparently agreed to do with the Iranians.
Well, they basically, we can talk to her blue in the face. They basically are submitting to Iran. End of story. There's nothing else to say. Iranians rule the roost. And let's just quote the Russian ambassador to these talks in Vienna, Ulyanov, who said he admired the Iranians. They fought for every comma, every this, every that, and the other thing. And everything they fought for, we submitted to. Here's the thing. In the Middle East, patience is absolutely important. There are no deadlines. And you used before the rug store analogy. Frank, you go into a rug store. You never tell the merchant what rug you're interested in. And you have to have time. If he knows you got to get out right away, bang, the price of the rug keeps going up and up and up. We have deadlines. Oh my God, we got to do this before this and before that. Excuse me. The Iranians' responses, we have patience. We can outwait the Americans. In the Middle East, that's the way it is everywhere. And the moment you go and if you say, I'm here, let's talk, let's have coffee, let's have tea, and you be nice, but you go nowhere and all that, the price goes down. And every time we give on an internal point, the Iranians say, thank God. And we go for another one. And it is, again, this is not an agreement. And please remember, all written agreements in the Middle East are nothing more than pieces of paper, if they're not backed by strength. And strength means not that I can destroy you or take you out for violating it, but that I've proven to you that I will. Like under President Trump, we took out Soleimani, who was one of the military geniuses of Iran. And that set them back a lot.
It did. And it commanded their respect, I think, in a way that nothing else did. And Harold, let me just ask you about one thing that we've been teasing out of this negotiation, and that is we're going to give them a lot more money. I've heard $10 billion at the low end and $150 billion, which is, I think, pretty much what we gave them the last time around. Is that imaginable to you? And what will the consequences be of that kind of money flowing into the hands of, what has been called, I think rightly, the world's most dangerous sponsor of terrorism?
Oh, it's very simple. It means they got all the cash they need to supply their allies, and they are other Shiites like the Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they're going to just, the level of terror is going to go up. But here's the bottom line, Frank, and I think it's extremely important. The Saudis, the Emiratis, and even the Israelis, because the present government of Israel is kind of weak. It's sort of left-oriented. All of them are realizing that they can't trust the one ally they want more than anything on their side, the United States of America, the 800-pound gorilla. And their response is, if we can't trust America, we're going to go it ourselves. We're going to go it alone.
Yeah. Well, it seems as though in some cases, Harold, they're making a further decision, not only that they're going to have to abandon their confidence in our protection. I mean, the Saudis, for heaven's sakes, as you know, have actually witnessed us not only recognizing, in effect, the Houthi rebels, as they're called, the Iranian proxies in Yemen, and, you know, taking them off the terrorism list, for heaven's sakes, but we're actually removing the anti-missile protection they need more than ever, the Saudis, because the Houthis keep attacking them with various rockets and missiles. So they're making that calculation. They can't rely on us, as you say, Harold, but they're also, it seems, increasingly inclined to make deals, or if you will, separate peace with people like the Chinese Communist Party, Iran's most important sponsor. What's up with that?
Well, I agree with you on one level, but here's another thing. If America truly abandons them, and they will know this if when and if this agreement is in fact signed, and it whatever is published. It frees them to do what? They're on their own. And I would say the greatest thing that could happen would be that if that happens, maybe when that happens, that the Israelis will simply take care of the Iranian nuclear problem. And Frank, as you know, I might have worked for the Pentagon all these years. I'm not a military expert. I'm a culture expert on Iran. And all I can do, there are some wonderful military analysts who know this, like tried and tested, and they know. And I have a simple question. Can Israel take out Iran's nuclear program if it decides to? And uniformly, I'm getting one answer. Yes.
Yes.
So that'll
Harold, that's the bottom line, and we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, for the moment. But we will be coming back to you with, I hope, more questions and more important insights into what the Israelis are contemplating right now and what the Biden administration might do to interfere with it. That's for another day. Harold Rode, thank you for your time today. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to do just that, and that you'll join us again tomorrow for more of the same. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.